IT system. We're refusing to work, but we have hard copies for the presentation. We'll work from those hard copies, and then this opens our meetings. The apologies that we have, Honorable Fundewald, FF Club, Honorable Makele, PAC, Honorable Mwango, IFP, which takes us to item 3 on our agenda. But before we can ask for the main presentation, I'm going to ask the Honorable Minister to give us an introductory presentation of this introductory presentation. Honorable Minister.
I needed to give background to this bill. It's a very unique bill in our democracy, unique even at the time that it was started, and I thought perhaps it's important that you understand it. Essentially, this is a bill that comes from the Portfolio Committee. I think for the first time in our history, the Portfolio Committee took the lead and introduced a bill. But the process of introducing bills means that they must be approved by Cabinet. So this is your bill. Essentially, you should be telling me about this bill. It belongs to you. In 1993, when we had concluded the discussions on CODESA and we were putting together the models that we would have wanted the Defense Force to comply with, and all the security services of the country to comply with, we put together a subcommittee that was a defense subcommittee reporting to the Transitional Executive Committee. And out of that, we had come up with a number of suggestions. And one of those suggestions was that we wanted to see a defense force that would understand the supremacy of political control over the defense forces. However, we wanted to make sure also that we were able to allow a certain level of democratic expression within the defense force so that should there be any problems, there would be a mechanism over and above, a grievance process that we had expected would be there that would respond to some of the concerns that might come up. So, first thing, we wanted the primacy of politics over the military. And then we proposed at that particular time in 1993 that the institution of a military ombudsperson should be established. We had introduced it at that time because we thought that it would also be a way in which Parliament would be able to oversee and safeguard that some of the rights of the military were being kept. Following that, we came into Parliament, and one of the first things that we did was to put together a white paper in 1996. And out of that white paper, we took most of those elements that we had agreed to in the negotiations around the Transitional Executive Commission in 1993, and we had agreed in 1996 that there should be a military ombudsperson. We were not quite sure at that particular time, we were not specific because it was a white paper, it was a policy paper, but we were very clear that a military ombudsperson whose main duties would be to monitor adherence to democratic civil-military relations, to undertake investigations at the request of Parliament, to investigate complaints against the SANDF by military personnel and members of the public as well, should be established. This is the white paper that we then put forward to Parliament for Parliament to approve. Thereafter, in Chapter 10 of the Defence Review, we go into detail on what it is that we had expected would be the nature of the ambulance person. The white paper believes that a military ambulance person inter alia will investigate complaints against the SANDF by military personnel. It is envisaged that the ombudsman person will address any military personnel matters which cannot be resolved through any other grievance mechanism that exists. This has always been part of what we wanted to do. Whatever we found when reading through the history of the department, very problematic, was at the point of actually establishing a military ombudsman person. By the time that we as a government were ready to establish a military ombudsman person, we already had a public protector whose rights, responsibilities are carved out in the Constitution. So before this was done, the Joint Standing Committee on Defense then called in or got in touch with Selby Barker, who was then the public protector, to say this is what our intention to establish the office of the public protector. He was very supportive of the idea. However, he indicated that he found that there would be a duality of responsibility. The public protector's rights are enshrined in the Constitution. We can't change that, even in the interim Constitution. And therefore, he found that all of those matters that we would have been dealing with in defense would have been covered by the rights and responsibilities of the public protector. In general negotiations with him, it was agreed, therefore, that the responsibilities of the military ombudsman person would be migrated from the Defence Force to the Office of the Public Protector, and this was done. However, in ensuing years, it became quite clear that the position of the military ombudsman person within the Public Protector was not quite what we had intended it to be. Neither ourselves as government nor parliament. And the minutes of the portfolio committee and the joint committee come back to this matter over and over again about what is it that we're doing about the issue of the military ombudsman person. Later on, when the public protector was Advocate Lawrence Mushwana, the same issue was raised with him. The public protector was also very supportive then of the issue of having an ombuds person, but equally, like Mr. Barkov, insisted that it should be within the office of the public protector. Their concern had also been that there would be a duplication of responsibilities. Their concern would also be at what level would the public protector, military public protector, operate. If they are appointed in terms of the Constitution, what therefore is the role of the public protector? So the correspondence between the then committee, the minister, secretary of defense, and the public protector was around exactly how to handle this matter. It seems to have been an ongoing matter for some time, but by 2006, the portfolio committee had taken a decision that they were going to take on this responsibility, and under the chairpersonship of Kada Asmal, they got permission from Parliament to request that a draft bill be drafted by a lawyer from the UCT School of Law. I'm just trying to get the name of the lawyer who drafted the bill. And the bill indeed was drafted in 2006 and was given over to the minister to introduce to Parliament. That was the brief history of why we had the problem that we had. When in 2009, late 2009, I got a letter. 2009, I got a letter from the new public protector. It was almost like music to everybody's ears, because what she was saying is, Minister, could you please take your military ombuds responsibility out of my office and put them in your office? far too complex for me, and I can do without them. 2009, therefore, we were able to get back to the bill that had been crafted and given to us by the portfolio committee and revive it and put it forward to cabinet in 2010 together, in 2010, to ensure that it has the compliance of cabinet. It has the compliance of cabinet now. Was taken through to the state law advisors. They have made some changes. I had a meeting with the public protector to go through the bill as amended by the state law advisors, and I have with me the recommendations that she made. They're not major recommendations, however, it's recommendations that perhaps will be dealt with if we go into the detail of the bill itself. Number one, we had wanted to change. Number one, we had wanted to change the bill from ombudsman to ombudsbill. So it was a gender we were worried about, and she thought that ombudsman is equally sufficient. She therefore insisted that it should still be ombudsman. So from time to time you might find reference to ombuds or sometimes ombudsman. That is for Parliament to make the necessary amendments or perhaps make a recommendation. But ombudsman was my preference because I thought that at some point there's got to be some gender sensitivity around some of these things. She overrode, and because it had to be a consensus, we agreed the bill, therefore, in front of you has changed, and it is the military ombudsman bill. The other matters that she thought perhaps within the context of the bill that we had given to her needed to be changed, and those also, in the context of your discussion, you'll be able to go through them and discover what they are because they have been taken on board. So I wanted to say to you that it has taken a long time for this to be where it is, but finally, when the public protector and myself met in May, and a meeting of minds had taken place, we have what we have now. My request to you is a straightforward bill that is part of policy that we have adopted. My request to you is if you could please check us and prioritize us. It's an absolutely urgent bill. I have no idea why it has taken so long for us to be here, but it is one that will make sure that within our military system, within the grievance processes, there is a way in which an ordinary soldier is able to find recourse for anything that perhaps they might feel that they have been there's been an injustice done to them. Chairperson, I believe I have given the necessary introduction. At any time that there are questions, I'll be able to answer those questions. If we could have this bill passed by this year, Chairperson, I will nominate the chair for a special honor in this event for my sincerest request. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Honorable Minister. I think I've got the honor already. Then, from what the minister says, Honorable Members, is that the processing of this bill is long overdue. Now, I'm not sure as to whether the Honorable Members want to interact with the introduction of the minister at this stage, or we should just get a presentation and have a full package. Right, then we can have the presentation, and then thereafter we interact with the introduction and then the introduction of two presentations here. The presenter can go on. General Mono.
Thank you, Chairperson, and all our members, Warren Minister of Defense, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. I'm I'm Major General Mona, Acting Chief Defense Legal Services. I'll give you the presentation. The aim of this presentation is to brief the portfolio committee on the regional objectives of the National Ombudsman Bill. However, with your permission, Chairperson, I will skip the original background, as mentioned, already done that very well. Comprehensive background has been provided. The Chairperson, the bill seeks to establish the Office of the Military Ombudsman and set requirements for appointment to the office. The bill further provides for the functions and powers of the ombudsman and his or her deputy. We'll also be dealing with the deputy ombudsman. Certain provisions of the bill, which are Section 2, Chairperson and members. Section 2 establishes the Office of the Military Ombudsman and empowers the ombudsman in consultation with the minister to determine the seat of the office. Section 3 sets out the object of the office, which is to investigate and ensure that complaints are resolved in a fair, economical, and expeditious manner. As you are aware, that members are entitled to this expeditious settlement of their grievances and so forth. Section 5 prescribes requirements for appointment and tenure of ombudsmen. The president appoints the ombudsman, and in consultation with the ombudsman, the president appoints the deputy ombudsman. In other words, the president will have the prerogative to appoint the ombudsman, then thereafter, in consultation with the ombudsman, appoint the deputy. The ombudsman is appointed for a fixed term of 5 years without no further extension of office. The president determines the remuneration and other conditions of employment with concurrence of the Minister of Finance. Ombudsman and the deputy ombudsman may be removed from office by the president on grounds of misconduct, incapacity, or incompetence. The president must afford the person's consent a reasonable opportunity to be heard before that removal may take place. So proceeding with the silent provision, Section 6, states as follows. It sets out powers and functions of the ombudsman and the deputy ombudsman. Ombudsmen investigate complaints fairly and expeditiously without fear or prejudice. Ombudsmen must inform all interested parties to the complaint before conducting investigation. Ombudsmen may summon any person to give evidence. He or she may confirm or dismiss the complaint or issue alternative resolution. Section 5 of the bill deals with limitation of jurisdiction of the ombudsman. The ombudsman may not investigate complaints relating to military judicial officer's performance, in other words, military judge presiding. The ombudsman cannot review or deal with that. Pending matters before military or civil court, and matters subject to other dispute resolution mechanisms. For example, we have a grievance mechanism within the department. When the matter is still entertained, has been entertained by the grievance committee, then the ombudsman may not deal with that matter. The ombudsman may refuse to deal with one, frivolous complaints, and complaints that may undermine channel of command. Section 8 provides for independence and impartiality of the office. Ombudsmen and the staff must perform their functions in good faith and without fear, favor, bias, or prejudice, subject to the Constitution and the law. Minister, Secretary for Defense, and Chief of the National Defense Force assist ombudsmen to protect independence and impartiality and dignity of the office. Employees and members must cooperate with ombudsmen. Also under Section 8, it is that office must preserve the confidentiality of any information acquired in performance of its function. Section 9 of the bill deals that staff of the Office of the Military Ombudsman. This is that is empowered. The Ombudsman is empowered to appoint staff to assist him in the performance of his function. Staff of Ombudsman must be issued with grading of security clearance by Intelligence Division of Defense Force. Furthermore, Ombudsman with concurrence of Minister and the Minister of Finance determines the remuneration and other terms and conditions of service of the staff. Coming to Section 10, it provides for the finances and accountability. It says that refunded from monies appropriated by Parliament for that purpose. And the Ombudsman is the accounting officer of the office in order to promote this independence. Section 11 deals with reporting of the Ombudsman. He or she will report to the Minister. The Minister must provide the public protector with Ombudsman's report and table the same in Parliament to this body. With regards to review under Section 13, decision of the Ombudsman is reviewable by High Court. This is the right of every citizen to have the right to recourse to the High Court of the land. In conclusion, Chairperson, an institution of this nature is not new in the public service. Independent Complaint Directorate for South African Police Services investigates complaints from public regarding police conduct and incidents of death in custody. Internationally, Canada has an institution of similar nature. The Ombudsman Office in Canada is tasked with the responsibility to review and investigate concerns and complaints from current and former Canadian force members, departmental employees, and their immediate family members who believe that they may have been treated improperly or unfairly by the Department of National Defense or Canadian forces. In short, Chairperson and members, this is the introductory part in follow-up what the Minister has presented. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we interact with the introduction presentation, Honorable Member? Honorable Minister, Honorable Mayor.
Thank you. If you're thinking through what questions to ask, I thought to indicate to you that in discussions with the public protector, we did want that the definition, I'm not sure if it has been put in place, that the complaint might also mean a request of a foreign investigation by Parliament. Going to the bill, it does look like there is no space in the nature of the complaint for an investigation from Parliament. We thought that we should give that responsibility that Parliament has to actually request and initiate an investigation through the ombudsperson. It also gives the necessary security to the soldiers that this is possible. Chairperson, there's also a matter which is discussed about the appointment of the ombudsperson. The ombudsperson. Chapter 5.2.2. It says that the President must, in consultation with the Ombudsman, appoint a deputy military ombudsperson. I don't know where this fits in with Parliament. The interesting thing is going through the minutes of the past, the ANC had been very insistent that the Ombudsman must be appointed by Parliament. But then DA had been insistent that it should not. I think they were represented here by somebody called James Self. So that has been part of the history of how we came to be here. But I thought that I'm not sure about the... We were not sure, the public protector and myself, about whether the deputy should be in consultation with the ombudsperson. We could say the ombudsman person and the deputy be appointed by the president, or give some space to Parliament in the appointment of the deputy. That is for you to consider. I think those are the matters that number independence and impartiality, it is chapter 8.3. No person may interfere with the functioning of the ombudsman. I don't know exactly, you might want to consider this chapter, what exactly this means for yourselves as Parliament. Number four, we might have a 8.4, we might have a problem, because in terms of the way we see the functioning of the ombudsperson, the person who would report to the ombudsperson would be the chief of the services. So if we say here that members and employees of the department must cooperate with the ombudsperson, then we are now we're now going into the domain of the ombudsperson being part and parcel of the administration of defence. So perhaps if you could just note that in your discussion, understand that we ourselves were thinking about them, but finally the bill will be yours, the bill is yours.
Thank you very much, Reverend. You need not worry much about that. The bill is still going to go through a process. We are still going to come back to you, and we'll factor all those things that just keep them, note them in the department. Honourable Minya.
Thank you, Chair. I don't intend to ask a question, but I would like to make a comment and a request. The comment is, I mean, we certainly welcome the tabling of the military ombudsman bill. The Minister, I think, is absolutely correct. It will make a big difference. And for that reason, we will certainly commit to working hard on the bill, even although I know there's no promise of and promise for the opposition. But this is an important bill, and we will certainly work hard on the bill. My request, Chair, I think it might help the committee in its deliberation as we go forward, if it would be possible for our researcher to furnish us with a copy of the original bill to which the Minister referred that was produced by the Joint Standing Committee on Defence. I think it might be also be helpful if we could have a copy of the Public Protector's recommendation in respect of the bill. And then I think it would be useful if we could have a copy of the founding legislation for the military ombudsman or a similar institution in Canada. And finally, it might also be interesting for us to have a look at the recent debate about surrounding the amendment of the ICD legislation. Amendments were made because there were deficiencies in the ICD. It might be useful for us to look at what those deficiencies were and what remedies were implemented as a result of the amending legislation. That's really just a request to our committee researcher. I think it might assist us all in the deliberations as we go forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Minya. Any other comment? Or we do not have any other comment, Honourable Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson. We will certainly be able to provide all the necessary information. And I want to assure the committee that the people who worked on the tightening up of the ICD legislation are the very law advisors who worked on this law. And they were very mindful that there should be uniformity. So that which was tightened up in the ICD, police ICD, has been tightened up and has gone before it was passed the Senate.
Thank you very much, once more, Honourable Minister. Honourable members, if there is no any other comment, the next administrative step to take is for the bill to be published, and then that should be done, and then we'll take it up from there. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Minister. We are now on the second the implementation of the Geneva Convention Bill, B10 2011. Leading us on this one. Would you go out? it is long outstanding chair. The Geneva Conventions were adopted in 1949. South Africa as a country ratified them in 1962. And in 1995, the additional protocol to the Geneva Convention were then ratified. Were immediately ratified upon the dawn of the new dispensation. The Geneva Conventions and their additional protocols are part of the international humanitarian law, which is a set of rules that seek to limit the effects of armed conflict on both combatants and non-combatants. And additionally, it regulates the use of weapons during an armed conflict. Articles 49, 50, 129, and 146, common to the 4th Geneva Convention, require all state parties to the Convention to annex relevant legislation to give full effect to the Geneva Convention. In terms of our own Constitution, Chair, Section 231, Sub 4 of the Constitution provides that any international agreement becomes law in the Republic when it is enacted into law by national legislation. And this bill, Chair, is drafted in response to the Republic's obligation under the Geneva Convention. But most importantly, as a response to the constitutional requirement of Section 231, if you want these conventions or any international agreement to be applicable within your territory or on your national, it must be domesticated so that you can be able to suppress any violations within South Africa. The bill, Chair, was approved by Cabinet and introduced in Parliament before the deadline of June 29. Now, Chair, just briefly again, we propose to just remind the committee what the Geneva Convention is about and what the additional protocols speak. There are four Geneva Conventions, Chair. The first Geneva Convention deals with the amelioration of the condition of the women and the sick in armed forces in the field. The second Geneva Convention, Chair, deals with the amelioration of the condition of the wounded, the sick, and the shipwrecked members of the armed forces at sea. In other words, it deals with maritime or naval issues. The third convention deals with the treatment of prisoners of war, those who fall in the hands of an enemy force. Amelioration. It means to minimize the effect of it, to minimize the effect of war on those wounded and sick. The fourth convention, Chair, speaks to the protection of civilian persons in time of war. Then there are two additional protocols of 1942. Protocol 1 deals with protection of victims of international armed conflict, in other words, a conflict between two different states. The second protocol, Chair, deals with the protection of victims of non-international armed conflict. That is, it may be a conflict within a particular state, where there may be rebels against the government or rebels between the two of them. Now, Chair, I propose to move to just introduce to the committee the structure of the bill and what the bill provides. Firstly, the first part of the bill, Chair, seeks to enact the conventions and their protocols into South African law, thereby giving the conventions the force of law. This also enables the South African court to apply and enforce the provisions of the Geneva Convention. Now, Chair, like I indicated, that a ratification of an international convention creates obligations for the state in how it interacts with other state parties. But domestication, which is what we seek to do with this bill, gives the state the power to prosecute and deal with contraventions by its nationals and within its territory. And now we have those obligations under international law. But what we have an obligation now in terms of the Geneva to make sure South Africans or our forces in participating in armed conflict, they comply with the obligation. And we seek to create a framework for the prosecution or the suppression of all the Chair, the Geneva Convention provides for two types of requisitions to suppress and prosecute. The first category is what we refer to as the grave breaking.
These were the serious carnivores of poaching, and they are set out in various articles of the convention. Article 50 of the first convention, Article 51 of the second convention, Article 130 of the third convention, Article 147 of the fourth convention, and Article 11 and 81 of the first additional document. Chair, we have circulated the list of what is a grave breach. That's for the benefit of the public. Because the manner in which the bill is captured, there are specific references to the article of the convention. So the list was thus to indicate to the public what exactly is contained in those specific clauses that we have. The second category, Chair, is what is called the other breaches. In other words, those are the breaches that are less serious or violent. In terms of the convention, they also have there have to be provisions for the prosecution of professionals. As indicated, Chair, the bill criminalizes all breaches of the convention and their additional protocols and provides for penalties depending on the nature of the breach. Interestingly, Chair, the bill takes it further. It does not only punish the violation of the convention, but also punishes the failure to prevent the commission of breaches by members under the command. In other words, it does not only deal with the positive violation where a commander or a member of the South African government has an obligation in law to prevent breaches, and he does not do so when he has been in a position to do so. That on its own constitutes. So in other words, it creates a positive obligation on all the commanders in the armed forces to make sure that breaches are not committed by their members.
And I'm sorry for keeping on interrupting. It tells a list of grave breaches that are captured in an extra. I can't find it in my presentation.
Maybe I need to check that there were two documents that were submitted by the department to the committee. The first one is the PowerPoint presentation, and there was a second document, which was a Word document. We will make copies there available. It seems like the document was not included in the committee. This was intended to assist the members in reading the PowerPoint presentation so that you can have the Word document. And the
annexa
is
that
adds to that
other document. We have an annexa, we copy them there, distribute to all members. You can go on there.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, again, the bill provides for extraterritorial jurisdiction. Now, Chair, the committee will recall that the Geneva Convention is one of the most ratified treaties in the nation. In fact, it's universally ratified. About 196 countries have already ratified it. So it is one of the first instruments internationally that has enjoyed the support of almost all the nations of the world. Now, that has implications as to how each country deals with violations of the Geneva Convention, hence the inclusion of extraterritorial jurisdiction. Now, the implication of universal ratification is that countries obtain universal jurisdiction over all violations. In other words, you are not only responsible in the country for your own national or for offenses committed within your territory. You are responsible for prosecution of offenses that may have been committed in other countries, and you have an obligation not only to protect you when they end up in your territory, but to seek and to search for the purpose of prosecution. So if you know as a country that there have been violations in a particular country of the Geneva Convention. Under the Geneva, you have an obligation not only to wait for people to come to your country, to deal with them wherever you find them. So that's the implication, hence the creation of extraterritorial jurisdiction. Because normally your jurisdiction will be limited to your nation, to your borders, and to your people. The third issue that comes from the bill is the issue of the status of all the detainees, including the prisoners of the war. It so happens that in certain instances that there is dispute as to the status of the person that has been captured, as to whether the general who was captured by the enemy forces is a prisoner of war or is a civilian internee.
sometimes less of that than others, I can't even determine the status of the person. A prisoner who are members of the defense of armed forces that have surrendered themselves or are injured or for whatever other reason can no longer take part in the war. So in other words, they may be injured, they may surrender, or for some reason they are no longer interested or they don't pose the threat to the enemy forces.
Or
captured. Those are the prisoners of war. So, but sometimes it's not clear because there are instances where civilians, although they are not part of the armed forces, maybe out of loyalty to their country, they may take up arms and start engaging the enemy. But if they are not combatants, they do not acquire the status of the former prisoners. They will be treated as normal internees. And that has implications in how they are treated. To the sense that prisoners of war, by their nature, cannot be prosecuted for an act of participation in war, because that's the cause of a defense force. So you can't prosecute a soldier for taking part in war. But you can only prosecute them for the violation of international law, such as the Geneva Convention. But on the other hand, the internee, other than prisoners of war, may be subject to prosecution for taking part in a war if they are not combatants. So that's why the issue of determination of status is important, because it has a difference on how the members and how the internees are treated. There is a procedure that is created in terms of which persons can go to court for a determination of their status first before any prosecution or proceedings are implemented. So the fourth issue is the issue of legal representation. Again, this is another new issue here. It flows from the Constitution in terms of which all persons who are accused or charged of crime are entitled to legal representation at the same expense or at their expense. The fourth issue here is the issue of the protection of embryos. Now, the committee will remember that under the Geneva Convention, there are certain prescribed embryos that should be used by religious personnel, medical personnel, for the purposes of their protection. Medical personnel and religious personnel are normally not military targets. In other words, you can't be wanted to attack against persons rather than medical services. In order for them to be able to protect themselves, they wear the red cross hand. In other countries, they prefer to use the red cross hand now, recently, the third African protocol. Internationally, the red cross has been recognized as another hand. So we provide you the deal for the protection of the use of those, because there are instances where the emblem can be used for purposes of ambushing the enemy. For instance, I'm a member of the military force, I put on a red cross, then I enter into the territory of the other force, and they do not attack me because they believe that I'm only there for religious or medical purposes. Then I ambush them. And that on its own is one of the great issues. So for that purpose, we protect the use of the emblem, describe instances who can use the emblem and for what purpose. And so I think at this stage I must indicate that there is another act within South Africa which is called the Red Cross Society Act, which is administered by the Department of Health. This act deals specifically with the use of the Red Cross by hospitals and other health service providers within the country. So this act is intended to reinforce or to complement that act, because the Geneva Convention is specific to cases of armed conflict. So we make specific provisions as to the use of the of the Red Cross in instances of armed conflict. So the two acts will be complementing each other. Again, so we make provisions for the use of the emblem specified by the FANDA. Now the committee will recall that most armed forces, their medical personnel and religious personnel, use the Red Cross for the purpose of protection of the personnel. So the defense force is also subject to use that at the direction of the military. So we just describe there how that will be governed and what they should wear in order to identify themselves. The other category of chairman that allows to use this emblem under the initiative is the International Committee of the Red Cross, the International Federation of the Red Cross, and the Red Cross Society of South Africa. Again, Chair, the last issue that we touched on was again the issue of the interface between the implementation of the Rome Statute Act, which is administered by the Department of Health. Now, grave breaches are categorized in international law as war crimes. It's crimes that are committed during the course of the war. Now, the Lone Star Troop deals with certain war crimes, but not all the war crimes under the Lone Star Troop include the crimes under the Geneva Convention. So this act, again, is intended to complement the ICC statute in as far as it excludes certain categories of jurisdiction. The second issue was changed, but any other thing when we talk about jurisdiction indicated that under the Geneva Convention, state parties have an additional obligation, that of seeking and searching for the violation. But under the ICC statute, we find that there is no capitalization. You want to deal with people as they come or land on the camp. There is no specific investigation to know how they seek and search. So again, that's to indicate the interface between the two pieces of the state. But I think the Geneva is specific to apply in instance of compulsion. Then in conclusion, again, we just highlight the issue that this bill should not be seen in isolation. In the past 9-10 years, the Department of Defense has presented various bills relating to issues of international humanitarian aid. In 2001, this parliament passed the Enterprise Personnel Act. Then it was followed by the prohibition or restriction of certain conventional weapons. At some stage here, we appeared before the committee presenting the national prohibition of mercenary activities and regulation of certain activities. So this bill should be seen in that broader scope of South Africa trying to enforce matters of international humanitarian aid within its borders and its nations. So this is another installment in that conversation. So I will stop there and then we'll take the question and clarification.
The question that would come is that this committee want to domesticate the Geneva Convention. The obvious answer would be yes, in accordance with our constitutional requirement to comply with international law. Now, the comment, I guess, will be within that context. Dr. Mangeni, Honorable JJ.
No, I just want to clear to your comrade, Chairperson. Clause 9.5, which is given by this person, may qualify for state legal representation. And there are cases where this person may not qualify. It says may qualify, in other words, I don't know. Can you say must qualify, this may qualify or shall qualify? Are there cases where this person may not qualify? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Blanket. Honorable JJ.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to clarify a situation whereby this country doesn't recognize maybe the people they're in combat with. Say, we don't recognize Swaziland as an independent country, and we get into combat with Swaziland, and we capture their soldiers. And we maintain that because we don't recognize them as a country, they don't fall under the Geneva Convention. So we treat them as simple detainees, or what you term internees. What happens under such a situation? Does the over and say maybe the UN recognizes Swaziland as a country, but we don't. The situation of Morocco and the Polisario Front. Another question, just for my information, why the religious people? I understand the Red Cross, but religious, why should they be protected? I'm thinking of a situation, a religious person in a combat situation would like what we had of the church being the one that is actually wrong. I can't understand why this religious person will just go around and give those people that were demoralized, give them morale to fight more, and we let this religious person do that. But just for my information. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, Congressman. Mine relates to a recent case that happened some months ago. The legal cases will help me. There was this guy from Nigeria who was arrested, accused of planning to kill his countrymen and women. And he was linked to the Niger forces, that group that fights in Nigeria, and that is an island or, the Niger Delta. I just want to find out how do we then using this Geneva Convention link that kind of a person to this kind of because there was a lot of confusion around his detention or his arrest. So what do you think? Can I get clarity on that one? Thank you.
Another word, Daniel.
Thank you, Chair. See, I'm not sure of the number of the countries that are part of the Geneva Convention. I just wanted to check if what are the implications if some of the countries are not part of the Geneva Convention? Do we then have jurisdiction over those countries and the persons in those countries in terms of applying the law?
Thank you very much. Can we have a response?
Thank you, Chair. I will attempt to answer some of the questions. Chair, with regard to the question that related to individual tests, I think, Chair, the point you are trying to make in the provision is that there is a separate piece of legislation that determines the criteria for people to qualify for legal aid as a state expects. So the use of may, Chair, does not indicate that people qualify or people do not qualify. But it's our way of deferring to that particular piece of legislation. Criteria applicable under the legal aid should be applied. But as far as I know, is that any person who cannot afford to hire his own at-home lawyer is entitled to go to the legal aid for legal representation. And there is a particular means test that they use to determine whether you are a person or not. So the use of may in this particular piece of legislation is just to defend, to say the criteria is prescribed somewhere. So we don't want to create any additional obligation that derogates from what the legal aid is. So there is a criteria, and they believe that I qualify because I don't have money now. But when I'm subjected to this, they will say, given the salary that you have, you do not qualify in terms of our criteria. So it may be that I have cash problems at that particular moment. But when they look at my income overall, they think that I shouldn't be getting any consistent. But ours was just to say we defer to that and the subject to the main test and that and not to discriminate between individuals and persons. The second
second question, Chair, was with regard to a situation where one country does not recognize another country, and what is the status of the people that they capture? I hope I got it right. Chair, the international humanitarian law really focuses on armed conflict. Where there is armed conflict, whether it's between two states or within a particular state, well, that's what Protocol 1 and 2 states are doing. You remember Protocol 1 deals with an international armed conflict, where it involves two states. But Protocol 2 deals with non-international armed conflict. In other words, where a legal movement within South Africa may be engaged in war with our defense. So it does not make any difference as long as we can determine that there is a particular armed conflict between South Africa and Swaziland. As to whether South Africa recognized Swaziland is not an issue. So the determining factor is that there is an armed conflict and people of another form, even if it was a legal movement, they would have been entitled to be treated in a particular way. So it's not so whether you recognize the other state, but what governs the application of the bill or the Geneva Convention is whether there is armed conflict. And armed conflict can happen within one territory. It could be a rebel force or an armed group within South Africa that is fighting with the defense force. So it will apply regardless of the status or the talent that you may have with the recognition of the other.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. My question was specifically on the treatment of prisoners, whether they will be prisoners of war or not. That was my question.
Chair, they will be prisoners of war. As long as there is armed conflict and there was a combatant in our. Now, I think maybe I should say this and add a rider to each other. International law deals with wars in two ways. Firstly, it deals with the right of countries or states to go to war. In other words, whether a particular war was a legitimate war, is that part of the international law? There's a second part of the international law which deals what we call law in armed conflict. So to that part, I say I either come. IADEL deals with an armed conflict, irrespective of the right of parties to go to that war. But the fact that there was an armed conflict, it applies automatically. So that's a distinguishing factor. We may debate as to whether the war in Iraq was a legitimate war. But IADEL does not deal with that question. All it says was there armed conflict in Iraq. If there was, the international humanitarian law applies. So the people who took part in that armed conflict are protected in prison. And I think that's the best. I will defer to my colleagues if they anything else to add. There was a question, Chair, with regard to religious personnel. Why should we protect religious personnel? Because they may be serving as some kind of moral duty. Chair, I think the principle here is armed conflict is between combatant to combatant. People who may be, in terms of international law, medical personnel are allowed to be in the area of armed conflict, but only for the purpose of tending to the wounded of the state. Same with religious personnel. The same way it applies with regard to death penalty. For a person is convicted of death penalty. Some people prefer to die after they have had their prayer. But religious personnel are only protected to the extent that they do not take any active part in the war. They are there to pray, they are there to attend to the spiritual needs of those people who are wounded and sick. So to that extent, they are protected because they do not pose any threat directly to the other side. And perhaps I will give you just another example as to how that would apply if we were not to make the distinction between combat and war. There are a number of logistical requirements for any nation to go into. And those logistical support may lie in civilian areas. For the defense force to go to arms, to war, we will need to get a supply of arms and stuff. And that supply of arms can come from a company here in South Africa. It could be DNL. But DNL, by its very nature, is a purely civilian institution. But it produces arms which is supplied. question may be then, would another nation be entitled to launch an attack against a civilian institution like the United States because it provides bullets? It manufactures and provides bullets, and those bullets are used for defense. So that's the question. That's why there is a principle of distinction. If a person does not pose any direct threat to the country, he cannot be a legitimate military power. So I think the issue of religious personnel is the same. They may be there, and they may be giving a good moral, but they do not take any direct participation in armed conflict. They are only tending to people who are already sick and wounded in any way, who are not posing a threat to you. And then there is that requirement that we need to distinguish. There are a number of things. This could be a breach that they are using. But can the breach become a legitimate target when in fact it serves other civilian purposes? So, but I understand your concern. This is a very debatable issue, even in international law, as to whether you would be entitled to destroy a breach if there are forces that are used. More especially if that breach is also used for purposes of civilian purposes. Will it be legitimate for a force to poison a water stream because the soldiers are reinforcing their liquid from there, when in fact that river may still be used for civilian purposes by other people? But you see, there is a very fine distinction. The moment you open it, you're opening a lot of civilians kind of to it in terms of the law they should not be exposed. But I accept that it's a very debatable issue. Chair, there was a question about the Niger Delta situation. It is a very complex situation for me, but I'll just go back to the principle I enunciated with regard to the issue of the religion. I mean, the recognition of the country. As I understand, and I'm not claiming to be accurate in what happens in Nigeria and the Niger Delta, but I think in my view the criteria should be a very simple one. We should be asking ourselves whether there is armed conflict in Nigeria. And I can talk for my view that as far as I'm concerned, there may be an internal disturbance. I don't think it has reached a level of an armed conflict. There is definitely internal disturbance. But international humanitarian law is not intended to apply to internal disturbance. The disturbance or whatever riot must develop into a fully fledged armed conflict between the countries. And an internal riot in Jobe does not amount to an armed conflict. So the police will be entitled to squash it through the means that they have and within the law. But that on its own cannot be categorized as an armed conflict. But once it's not an armed conflict, international humanitarian law does not apply. So a riot and somebody who just goes on a shipping cookie and chats to in Pretoria, that is not an armed conflict. It may be an internal defense issue when I'm dealing with it through your normal law and what I call. So that's a distinction we just need to make. But I'm not an expert on either health situation. But I would assume if there's a situation where we've got a normal internal defense, we should be dealt with through the normal law enforcement.
Thank you. No, you are not done. We are not discussing the bill. Yeah. I know what you worried about. You say, I could have been in Robben Island at this time. If I okay, Honorable Mlangeni and Honorable Mlangeni.
Why is international law being applicable in Libya? External forces, I'm not taking sides. I just want to clear it to on the explanation you've made. This was supposed to be an internal matter, civil rebellion in the country, in Libya. But external forces have come in. Unlike in Egypt, when Hosni Mubarak was overthrown by the people of Egypt, in Libya, as opposed to the Libyans tried to do the same, but have not been successful up to this stage. But we see international law being applicable here. United Nations has taken a decision. NATO forces are there. legal aid, food, etc., etc., have been supplied to civilians in the country. Why is that so? Why is that this distinction like that? It's a civilian war, but international law is applicable. But it's not supposed to be. It's an internal war.
Not an
talking about our security forces who have made an arrest within our border, where a Nigerian, some of the things that are said here on this Geneva Convention in terms of exercise our muscles as government. To say this person was arrested on suspicion that he has committed an offense, but he was operating within our borders. You see, so already seemingly to me, I'm not a legal person. It says some of the things that this bill is trying to come up with already as a country has implemented some of the things because of our arrested a person on suspicion that is operating within our borders, and he has planned one of the deadliest operations that took place in his country.
He has conspired and armed the conflict in another country. That is the case of Kofa.
I think this is the moment where I issue it again. I'm on very shaky ground, and I only want to ask a certain opinion on this issue. And as we know, it's a matter that is subject. But I think I can only indicate that the person in question is a firefighter and a member of the SF under the empty terrorist investigation under the police. I just can't remember the exact name of it for anti legislation. But I think the legislation has an extraterritorial jurisdiction. Terrorist activity is no longer an issue of jurisdiction. I think I will leave it at that actually before I say things I should be saying. And I think the same honorable Mr. Mangeli, the issue of media is a very dicey situation. I don't think it's safe for an official to express an opinion other than to say the issue of media relates to issues of youth acts at whom rather than youth in the room. Remember I said the right to go to war and the right, I mean the law in war. We are dealing in our view with law in war. As to whether the nations of the world were entitled to intervene in Libya is a matter that is regulated by different people, but by the UN Charter and all those. But it's a different thing from where they war. What we can say is that there is an armed conflict in therefore, the international humanitarian law and how people, civilians are protected. I think I will lose the conflict.
Thank you very much, General.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Chairperson. Just to add what Mr. Ndugela has just indicated, there are certain situations that will not necessarily can be considered as black and white, you know, when it comes to this issue. For example, mentioning that gentleman from Nigeria who is now in South Africa, who is the issue of extradition, where he should put him to Nigeria and so forth. There's another similar case, not exactly, but one running from Rwanda to Syria, to when I accused him that he was trying to support the state or all the stuff. He got offense. But he granted him protection. So there will be this kind of situation that doesn't necessarily fit like a glove into the situation, that needs to be looking to that context.
Grey areas. JJ, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson. You see, I might seem that I don't like police, but maybe it's because there's no point of order when police to talk or point of correction. But I still think, sorry, maybe in this convention, if you propagate for war, you might be prosecuted. That's my thinking. And this priest is propagating for war, telling his soldiers to fight very hard. I think with the jurors that they don't belong in being protected. Well, it's just a comment. Thank you.
If you say kill those cockroaches, a priest.
A priest is not supposed to propagate for war. When he goes to the front, when he goes to the soldiers, he goes there to pray for them, to pray for their souls, not for their bodies, to pray for their souls. He is not supposed to say, you must fight this enemy. If he does that, then he's no longer protected by the law. He's not supposed to do that. If they do it, they are guilty of propagating war. As simple as that. Not supposed to be doing to do what you say they are ready to do. If he does it, then it doesn't fall under our protection or law.
I'm going to adjourn this meeting. Thank you very much, Honorable Member. This is a very interesting piece of legislation. Now it takes us into the international arena. Thank you very much. And then we will follow the same process that we are following with the Ombudsman. This will be published immediately for public to comment. But she's not here. There was a question that she has only been to the deputy. She says her question was not answered. It will be answered in the next time. You're sure?
I'm impressed with you.
Yes, cool.
member of the 3CG on his own.
Hello, man.
Hello, man.